Okay. Can I begin?
You're rolling, Rebbe.
I can roll? Okay. Today is Monday, October 11th, 2010. And I want to say good morning to my students in front of me and to all those listening on the magic of modernity. Today is a fascinating shiur. Again, I want to tell you that many people have lectured on the conservative movement and maledicted them. As you notice, I'm not going that way. I want to understand them. I want to show you who was involved, what they thought. There's a sublineal message, because I think you understand that all these people were very honest people and really thought that this was the way of tomorrow, the way to go, this was the future for Judaism. I don't believe anyone dreamt what would ultimately happen. Now, Solomon Schechter and the Fukhazi and Catholic Israel, which we spoke about yesterday as well, that is basic. And again, I repeat what I've said for the last two lectures. I don't believe he thought it out to its ultimate conclusion, because once you put religion in the hands of the masses, I need not tell you the lowest common denominator will win out, and I can only say that nowadays low is lower than lower. Who would ever believe the world in which we live, that same-sex marriages are viewed as normative and should be sanctified, etc. Cyrus Adler, as I explained last week, succeeded Solomon Schechter. And Cyrus Adler was certainly 100% observant in his personal life. He was an academician, an administrator. He was a bit of a cold person. He was not a Zionist. He was not a theologian. And he played little role outside of very successfully administrating the seminary, Dropsy College, concomitantly, earlier being an administrator in the Smithsonian Institute. Louis Ginsberg was the dominant faculty member, and there's a world to talk about with Louis Ginsberg, a tremendous Louis. He tells the yeshiva boy, a Slabatka yeshiva boy, a Musanik, everything that went with Louis Ginsberg, and ultimately a troubled soul when he saw what was happening at the seminary. In his personal life, certainly Louis Ginsberg was observant. He may have had kulat. I think I mentioned to you his greatest leniency was that he ate swordfish as his first course on Friday night. But to fault him for eating swordfish, you can't exactly do, because the Noda Yehuda was Mata Swordfish. And there's a book coming out. I see Gil Elimelech. Am I pronouncing his name right? Gil Elimach, how does he pronounce it? How does he pronounce it?
El Maleh.
So I see he's coming out with a book on fish. I have a feeling he must deal with the whole controversy around the swordfish and the Noda Yehuda and the forged tshuva. There's a whole world in there. Anyway, that was Louis Ginsberg. But Louis Ginsberg, too, as far as with students, he was more the scholar than the personality, although he certainly was more of a personality than Cyrus Adler. Now, the man who really had the greatest influence in the seminary and ultimately on American Jewry, negative, positive, I can only tell you that if not for Mordechai Kaplan, the whole face of American Jewry would have been different. I am convinced, I can prove it, we will get there. But Mordechai Kaplan's life story is one that movies are made out of. His years, first of all, 1881 to 1983. The last few years of his life already, he suffered from dementia. He was fairly active and good till about 97, 98. I knew him in his 90s. And I can tell you he was alive and alert and filled with personality. Now, his life story is very simple. Without going into great detail, because this is a number of lectures unto itself, the Jews on the east side of New York were very upset that their kids, you know, by the 1870s, 1880s, you had a lot of people who had come over from Eastern Europe. And they were concerned that their kids were becoming assimilated. To use the Yiddish expression, the Kinder werden Goyim. Children are becoming Goyim. They were upset. So they kept on thinking, what can we do to guarantee that our children should be Jewish. So they looked to England, and England, you understand, in England was amazing. The general population worshipped in an Orthodox synagogue. While not everyone was observant, the shul they went to was a shul with a mechitza, with a balcony, and we know that that exists in England until today. Those of you that have spent time in England, you know, when I say United Synagogue, you know what I'm talking about. Today in England, there is the United Synagogue, there's the Federation of Federated Synagogues, or whatever, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and yeah, then there's the Kadassia, which is even more than the Federation. But all these shuls are Orthodox. I would say that 90% of the Torah, of the Jewish places of worship, are Torah synagogues. So they looked to Europe and they said, why is England so different? And they reached the conclusion that England has a chief rabbi. Rabbi Nathan Adler has a chief rabbi, a Talmud of the Chatam, Talmud of the Chatam Sofer. And why don't we have a chief rabbi? And if we have a chief rabbi, our world will be different. Our children will be from, people can be educated. And this was their dream. Then the big machlokut began, who to bring over as chief rabbi. I have to tell you, a lot has been written, but a real beautiful doctorate is yet to be done on this issue. And they decided to bring over the Malbim. They wanted someone who had a doctorate, who was broad. This is what they need in America. Someone who will be respected by the Reform Jews, by the Goyim. Who could be better than the Malbim, who was a gonadir, a gadol b'Torah, and a man of broad vista with a doctorate? The Malbim accepted, started to travel. Ein mazal Yisrael, the Gemara in Brachot, 1879, I believe. The Malbim dies in Bucharest, Romania, on his way to Germany, where he was going to take a boat from Hamburg and sail to the United States. After the Malbim died, they started fighting and pulling hair, and machloket went on. Finally, by 1887, he arrives. They settled on Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Who was Rabbi Yaakov Yosef? RJJ. First of all, some of you may have grandparents, right? Anyone here have grandparents? Or I don't think you have fathers who studied in RJJ. All right. Who's RJJ named after? Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Who is Rabbi Yaakov Yosef? He was the Magid Meshurim in Vilna. Vilna, again, everything I'm saying I could lecture on for hours. You follow me, Shmuel? I'm just biting my lips, but I don't want to go abroad. I don't want to start. I had a Rebbe in before the Rav. No matter where the Shir began, we wound up in Kudshim Bitar. It had nothing to do with Baba Batra that we were learning. Take my word for it. But I don't want to be like that. But still, I have to give you the background. So why did they? RJJ was a gonadir. Vilna had no chief rabbi, because in the time of the Vilna Gaon, Rav Shmuel was the chief rabbi, and there was such machloket in Vilna, they made an ordinance, we will never have a chief rabbi again. It's like YU. In YU, anyone teaching Talmud full-time is called a Rosh Yeshiva. I was called a Rosh Yeshiva from 62 on. I was on the Reitz faculty, you follow me? So Rosh Yeshiva at that time began from first year high school, all of college, smicha program. It was one yeshiva, it was integrated, not like today. So I used to say, what? Why do they call everyone a Rosh Yeshiva? Because if they started saying he's the Rosh Yeshiva, there'd be so much machlokes. To avoid machloket, every Tom, Dick, and Harry, you're teaching Gemara full time, gesunte het, you're a Rosh Yeshiva. When Mr. Gris, Zichrono Levracha, gave the first $1 million to the yeshiva, for the Rosh Yeshiva salaries, because, again, read my new book, I've spoken about it many times, this is why I'm sitting here. So they said, how do we define a Rosh Yeshiva if he teaches Talmud full-time in the yeshiva? So they wound up with many, many Rosh Yeshiva. Same thing here. Vilna, they had a Beis Din, and one was the Av Beis Din, one was the Magid Meshurim, the town preacher, one was in charge of Kashrut, but no one was called chief rabbi. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was the Magid Meshurim. He was the Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. He was a wonderful speaker. He lacked a general education, but he was broad, and a broad individual, a wonderful speaker in Yiddish, an emistic magid, and he was the compromise candidate. 1887, he arrives in America, and he brings with him two other rabbanim to form a Beit Din, just like in Vilna. One of the rabbanim he brought with him was Reb Yisrael Kaplan, the father of Mordechai Kaplan. So that's how Mordechai gets to America, a little boy, born in 1881, gets to America about 1887, and he joins Reb Yaakov Yosef. Now, to come back to Reb Yaakov Yosef and end it off, his story in America was a bitter gelechta, a very bitter joke. Why? Why in England did they have a chief rabbi, and why in New York City on the east side, within a few months of Raj and Jay's arrival, a rav from Moscow, Rav Yudovitzer, puts up a sign, Chief Rabbi of America and Canada. So they asked the Muscova rav, as he was called, who made you Chief Rabbi of America and Canada? He said, the sign painter. You see, America has total freedom. England, I was in England last winter. They want me to, I feel very bad. I have a lot of devoted followers there. And I know they're listening, so I will return. I just have to work it out. So I spent I spent 3.5 weeks giving, I gave 26 different shiurim in the Golders Green, Hendon, and Edgware last winter. So I got to know England quite well. I was taking guided tour of Stamford Hill, etc. So I can tell you, England is very conservative. You know, it has that feeling, love for tradition. And I have to go further. The Queen comes by, everyone stands up, everyone honors her, the Queen of England. I met good Jewish women who told me they cried when they met the Queen. I don't believe anyone would cry if they shook hands with President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton. I'd look at my hand afterwards to see if it was still there after I would shake hands with him. And particularly if I'm a lady, I wouldn't advise it. But you know, America's America. It's a different environment. They brought a chief rabbi, big deal. Right away got involved with kashrut, a penny less, a penny more. RJJ's sojourn was horrendous. By 1895 he had a stroke. He was bedridden. At his funeral there were riots, the goyim, the whole company. It's just beyond words what that man went through. Today, on his yard site, Satan Hasidim go to his grave, thousands of people come and say Tehillim, and it's a miracle. He died in 1902, and imagine 108 years later, he's revered, he's remembered in the latest issue of Jewish Action, which I gave you, I think I had two or three copies, I gave it out in class a week or two ago. There's a picture of RJJ's grave. I was there too, so don't exclude me from the crowd that goes to revere his memory. Now, Mordechai Kaplan goes to, gentlemen, what are you sitting in? You are sitting in Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Ochanan. How did the yeshiva begin? With an elementary yeshiva, 1886, called Yeshivat Eitz Chaim. In 1896 or 1897, Reitz and Eitz Chaim combined, and the name Reitz is the one that carries on, as Rakepin has explained a million times over, Gili. To the East European emigrant to the United States, the name Reb Yitzchak Ochanan meant a great deal. You follow? It's like if you ask me what name would mean, what should we name this campus for this Kollel, the Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Kollel. You follow me? That's the name that's going to live on with me, that you fellas already don't know who the Rav was and think the Rav was like every other great Rav, and yet you don't. I mentioned to a fellow in the Kollel, the Rav gave a psak, I mentioned his psak, and yet the Shani, you know, his attitude, oh, so what, there are the psak, and there are the poskim, this, other, this, other, that, all right. That I had heart failure from that attitude is incidental, but I understand already. But to the immigrants on the east side in the late 1890s, when Reb Yitzchak Ochanan Spector died, every immigrant had his picture. They could be Mechalalei Shabbos, but the picture of Reb Yitzchak Ochanan was in their house. So the name Reb Yitzchak Ochanan carried on. So you should know that Mordechai Kaplan went to Yitzchayim, went to Yitzchok Kochanan, and then he winds up, there wasn't much choice, in JTS, Columbia University, and he winds up the first English-speaking Orthodox rabbi to the East European crowd. What's the story? There was a very prestigious Orthodox synagogue on the Upper East Side, a synagogue that until today is the plum of the diaspora rabbinate. Outside of Israel, I don't believe even the chief rabbi of England does not make the salary that Rabbi Haskell Lookstein makes as rabbi of Kehillat Jeshurun, KJ. I don't have to tell you that if immigrant Jews lived on the Upper East Side already in the 1890s, the 1900s, they made it big. They couldn't speak a good English, but they knew how to make money. They were Kabbalah, they built buildings, they were in real estate, they were in manufacturing. I want you to know, many of them were Shomer Shabbos. Some of them had sons who became world-famous gangsters. I once, I don't want to mention names now, but if you know about the White Sox scandal, 1919, it all came out of KJ, the son of one of the trustees, who gave a lot of money to Tzedakah, including to what is today Yeshiva University. So you're sitting on chairs that if you trace it back, part of the chairs were given by Jewish gangsters who owned America and fixed the 1919 World Series. All right. Halavai, the idiots here threw out Bugsy. Well, who was that fellow? What was his name? Mayor Lansky. And he goes back to America, and they never indicted him. It's a crime what Israel did. The man wanted to spend his final years here. Terrible crime. Don't forgive. And it was done by Mizrahi people who then were in the Ministry of Interior, and they shipped him back to Florida, and he was never indicted. So bear that in mind, that Aaron Rakefet bears a grudge against Joseph Burg for signing the papers of extradition for a man who wanted to spend his final years. What could be so wrong? All right, gentlemen, you don't even start to realize what I'm talking about, because on the 75th anniversary, and all this can be checked out, on the 75th anniversary, I believe it was, of what is today Yeshiva University, they looked around for their oldest graduate. And lo and behold, the Community Public Relations Department, Sam Hartstein, they're beating the drums. It's in all the newspapers. Yeshiva University seeks oldest living graduate. And lo and behold, Mordechai Kaplan steps forward to say he is the oldest living yeshiva graduate. He was in his late 80s at the time, if I recall correctly. Why you were shaking. Could you imagine? They have to honor Mordechai Kaplan. It's a true story. They are desperate. They do a search in all the old age homes, and they come up with a guy totally dementia, totally senile, but he was older than Mordechai Kaplan. They honored him. They gave him a medal. They went to visit him. The picture appeared in every Anglo-Jewish newspaper. Let me tell you why you breathe a sigh of relief. And as I said yesterday, I said Hallel, because it was a geula for them that they didn't have to honor. Oh, could you imagine if they had to honor Mordechai Kaplan? Now, Mordechai Kaplan, how does he come to KJ? The rabbi of KJ, these wealthy Jews wanted a big, important rabbi, a Talmud Chacham, a Yudah Peyashadam, and Rabbi Moshe Zulman Margolis Ramaz. I believe if you've held the Rothkopf's first two books in your hand, so you see Rothkopf reproduces pictures of Ramaz. He was, the way a Rav should look, with a long beard and wearing rabbinic clothes, and that was their rabbi. But by the 1910s, there was already a second generation in the shul. And the second generation, it's like when you raise kids in Israel. The parents speak English to each other, the kids speak Hebrew to each other. And you've all been exposed to that. You all have relatives who have come in Aliyah. I mean, I have friends whose grandchildren can't speak a word of English. I said, who would ever dream that you would have grandchildren, Makis, greenhorns, to use words that I just read yesterday in Leon Gleisch's memoir of the Holocaust and then coming to America. He was called the Maki, a greenhorn. I forgot the word Maki. Do you recognize that word? I don't even know what the origins are. It was like you call someone a greenhorn, a Maki, you know. It means you don't know anything about America. You don't speak proper English. Get out of here, you Maki. Your English is worthless. So the second generation already felt more at home in English. And they, although they revered Ramaz, they wanted a rabbi who would speak in English on occasion. And that's how Mordechai Kaplan becomes the assistant to Ramaz at KJ. Now, Mordechai Kaplan was from, was pious, was a good preacher. No one knew what was going on in his head. Only about 1916, and much has been written about Mordechai Kaplan, you can check it all out, only later did he start espousing theories. There was no revelation at Sinai. The Torah is not divine. People asked him, what's happened to you? He said, and this is to his credit, he said, no, I felt this way a long time. So why didn't you speak up? Why are you fooling the people? He said, I couldn't speak up. My parents were still alive. I didn't want to hurt my parents. So all his deviations only come out after his parents are dead. You know what's amazing? He comes up with the idea now. He wants to do his own act. And those of you who will be assistant rabbis, you know, you can be an assistant rabbi 2 years, 3 years. After a certain time, you're going to get an itch. Time for me to go out on my own to be a rabbi. He decides it's time to leave KJ, go out on his own. And he has this amazing idea. We need more than a synagogue. We have to attract every member of the family. It's not sufficient just to have a synagogue. And he envisions a Jewish center, a meeting hall, a social hall, a library, classrooms, a pool, very important, in addition to a synagogue. He goes a basketball court. I would have been happy had it a baseball, but it's much a baseball court, baseball field. You need much more room. I said that, by the way, when I defended Naomi Rankin. I told the court, you know, I don't go into details, but you know, a pear and an apple. Do you know what I'm talking about? That one book said, can you change a pear into an apple? And one book said, can you change a fish into a bear or something like that? I forgot already. So I said to the court, that ilu ani katapti at the sefer hayiti kotev emefshal lishanot baseball lefootball kadur basis lekadur regel, and even the judge was laughing. You understand? So I would have been happy with a baseball, but it didn't work that way. You're right, a basketball court. And he founded the Jewish Center, the illustrious Jewish Center. Dov, have you davened there on occasion? Where Rabbi Lam was rabbi, Rabbi Young was rabbi, Rabbi Berman, my Talmud, was rabbi.
Rabbi
Eckstein, yeah.
My father was the first assistant rabbi.
Ah, so you know what I'm talking about. So the Jewish Center, the famous Orthodox shul on the Upper West Side, was founded by Mordechai Kaplan. But then Mordechai Kaplan moves on and he starts preaching. And a tremendous machloket breaks out in the Jewish center. How can we keep a rabbi who is, to put it mildly, an apikoros? And finally, in the 1920s, he leaves the Jewish center. Basically, he had to leave. He was thrown out. I mean, it couldn't go on that way. And he took some of the most important families from the Jewish center, went with him. Families split in half, like the Lamport family. Some remained Orthodox, and some moved with him up the street, where he founded the first shul with his understanding, Reconstructionism. It was Mordechai Kaplan, the founder of Reconstructionism, a new movement and yet not a new movement within American Judaism. Now, what do I mean a new movement? What do I mean not a new movement? Very simple. No famous rabbi in America just rabbinated. You also taught. Rabbi Dr. Leo Young taught me Jewish ethics, Yeshiva College. Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein taught me homiletics. Rabbi Joseph H. Lipstein taught me homiletics. The three most important rabbis. Another very important rabbi, Rabbi Dr. Gilbert Klapperman of Beth Shalom in Lawrence. He should live and be well. He's alive, and I met him a year ago. Must be in his 90s. He's a Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He's well. God should watch over him. He taught me Jewish sociology in college. Mordechai Kaplan taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary. Not just taught. He was the most popular teacher, the most beloved professor, wonderful lecturer, dramatic, sense of humor, friendly with the students. Started teaching there when the world thought he still was 100% from, 100% Orthodox. So that when he goes out and organizes his own synagogue, which by the way he calls the Society for the Advancement of Judaism. It's a very fancy name. No one ever referred to it by Society for Advancement of Judaism. Everyone called it the Reconstructionist Synagogue. But it's a new movement. And yet it's not a new movement because he finds himself in the seminary. Now, what is there, what is unique about Mordechai Kaplan? What is the heart of his message? His magnum opus, which explains it all, was published in 1934, Judaism as a Civilization. And the heart of his message, God may or may not exist. The existence of God is incidental to Judaism. What is Judaism? An evolving civilization. It's the Jewish people from time immemorial which has created a way of life through its patterns of behavior and the folk ways which it devised. Now, what does this mean? There may or may not be a God. But the way Jews live is a product of the way the Jewish people invented a certain lifestyle. And I'll tell you the famous anecdote. Everyone tells this story. I call it an anecdote because I can't prove whether it really happened. But Mordechai Kaplan did not carry on Shabbat. He wore two handkerchiefs tied together around his neck like a scarf. So they asked him, Professor Kaplan, what's going on? Why don't you carry? You don't believe in God. You don't believe in halacha. It's all a folklore. Why don't you carry? And he answered, my father didn't carry. My grandfather didn't carry. This is part of the Jewish civilization. Fine. Shmuel, you can accept the answer, not accept the answer, but it's a valid answer. Azehot mein katakitan. We heard that from the Rav many times. Lahavdil, a million times over, between Mori Rebbe and Mordechai Kaplan, but it's a valid answer. Lo and behold, one Shabbos, there's a heavy rain in New York, and they find Mordechai Kaplan walking in the rain with and umbrella. Have you heard this story? And of course, Jews come over to him. Mordechai, Professor Kaplan, it's Shabbos, how are you carrying an umbrella? And he answers, for a civilization, you do not get sick. I repeat, for a civilization, you do not get sick. This is Mordechai Kaplan. Let me take it a drop further. Let me make it absolutely clear to you. No, but we wouldn't carry an umbrella on Shabbos. So he's right. Believe me, he's right. He's right. One of the worst problems is when it rains on Shabbos. I mean, I have rain clothes that you can't believe. I have rain pants. I have a poncho. I can walk out. I remember I was once in a shtibble in Borough Park Friday night. It came down. It rained more that Friday night than it rains in Israel in a whole year. So I remember how I came to shul and the Hasidim, and many of them are my own Hasidim, helped me get dressed afterwards. They said, oh, Ashrei Mishabolakan de Pomodobia, you are well prepared. I said, look, I'm not used to the rain. And I'm, even though I only had 2 blocks to walk, it can be very frightening when it's coming down in a torrential storm. So this is Mordechai Kaplan. The Reconstructionist prayer book that we spoke about, I'm now quoting from the introduction. Quote, this is Mordechai Kaplan. Not God revealed the Torah to Israel, but the Torah revealed God to Israel. Do you understand what that means? I repeat, not God revealed the Torah to Israel, but the Torah revealed God to Israel. This implies that the Torah is the source of the Jewish conception of God, rather than that God is the source of the Torah. And you just think about what Mordechai Kaplan wrote. Now you can understand why there was such opposition to the prayer book. Give me one second. But what is he saying? God may not exist. Or to put it in very simple pedestrian language, God is a figment of the Jewish people's imagination. And we develop this lifestyle. And this is Mordechai Kaplan. He had a follower in Israel who had been a general in the Israeli army. He's no longer alive. An interesting person, Mordechai Bar-On. And he had studied in America. He had a master's. He maybe even had a doctorate afterwards. But in America, he got a master's. A very bright person he was, if I recall correctly. He was in charge of chinuch in the army, which I don't think it happened today, because the army has to be much more careful about who they appoint to positions that the Torah Jew will object to. And he was a Reconstructionist. And in the Reconstructionist Journal of October 1977, he wrote an article. The title of that article captures Mordechai Kaplan 100%. The Commandments and the Commander. And what was the whole concept of the article? That we can have commandments without a commander. There's no God. God is unimportant. God is not the essence. God is not the heart. No. We have commandments. Commandments developed from the Jewish people. Historical development. Reconstructionism. We reconstruct life in accordance with the Jewish people's way of life. We are different than the Gentiles, but it's not God-oriented. It's people-oriented. This was Mordechai Kaplan. Commandments without a commander. God is a product of the Torah, not the opposite. Not that the Torah is a gift of God to the Jewish people. This was Mordechai Kaplan. Now, I'll go further in 1 second. Yes, yes.
Can I ask two questions?
Go ahead.
So one is concerning trying to make the synagogue like more expansive in terms of its function. Isn't that really what the synagogue used to be a couple thousand years ago?
No, we can have no, you may be very right. The synagogue was called the Beit Ha'am, if you're familiar with the Gemara. You may be right. No one objected to the Jewish center. Today, we Chabad, have you gone to Russia lately? Go and see what Chabad is built in Russia. It's exactly a Jewish center. No one objected to that. But what they objected to, this type of theology. Wow.
The other question is, according to him, there's no real difference then between Judaism and any other culture. Right?
In other words, it's a Jewish culture. But each culture developed on its own, nothing to do with divine revelation.
And he would say that a Hindu really shouldn't eat meat because his father didn't eat meat.
Right, he wouldn't eat treif because his father didn't eat treif. He didn't write the shul on Shabbos because his father didn't write the shul on Shabbos. Yes, Danny.
I know we mentioned that last week that three of the staff members at JPS.
We'll come to that, dear. We'll come to that in a second. Hold the question. I just want to make one more point before we come to that because I'm in the 30s now. Now, I have to tell you something very, very important. And I've said this before, and it's crucial to understanding not just theology and Jewish history, halacha. Crucial. Look, man does not live in a vacuum. We're alive at a certain period. If you recall my lecture last year on the relationship with Haredim, which I'm very proud of that lecture. You know, Mendelssohn came out of the ghetto. His children were overwhelmed by freedom, by choice. We live out of the ghetto. We don't live in a vacuum. But we're fortunate we were born already after Jews have lived out of the ghetto for 250 years. So we're not overwhelmed. And we're able to survive as good Jews. But you can't remove the theology, the thinking, the rabbinic leadership from the era in which it happens. Now, you know what's amazing about Mordechai Kaplan? When did he hit his peak? When is his book published? 1934. Can anyone tell me what was going on in the 1930s? Depression. People were committing suicide wholesale. You know what it's like to be wealthy and a year later to sell apples on the street to survive? You have to understand what was going on. My mother, she lived in Israel, never put her money in one bank. I used to say, Mom, what are you, crazy? Three banks, four banks. She says, Ani, you don't remember the Depression. We had to wait in line to take out. You were limited, I think, to, I don't know, check it out, I think $100. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was $10. And each bank, that's the only amount of cash they would give you, no matter how much was on the books. You know, it was a terrible period. And, of course, Nazi Germany rising, Hitler, fascism, communism, Stalin. How could you believe in God? And many people have explained to me that Mordechai Kaplan could be unbelievably successful in the 1930s because the times in which he espoused his theory were very fruitful for this type of thinking. It fell like rain on parched soil. This is great. You have a religion with no God. You have a religion. This is the Jewish lifestyle. Americans think a certain way, dress a certain way. It's the American lifestyle. What characterizes America? I don't know. You can come up with many tremendous stores, endless shopping, Walmart. That's America. The British, the pubs. Everyone works till 5, head for the pubs, fish and chips. Italy, pizza, wine. Everyone has a different civilization. The Russians, vodka. No, not difficult to characterize the Russian civilization. I've been there. Vodka. The Jews, a bit of Shabbos, a bit of Kashrut. Civilization. No commander. It's a brilliant concept that Baruch wrote. It explains Kaplan in three words. commandments without a commander. In his introduction to the Siddur, he writes a big sentence. The Torah did not reveal God. God did not reveal the Torah, but the Torah reveals God. All right. Then, of course, right after World War II, he comes out with the Siddur, and times are changing. The sands are shifting. Jews have been butchered. Jewish life is coming to an end for anyone who thinks logically. Oh, people can't believe we have a tomorrow. And on the ashes of Auschwitz, Treblinka, etc., the state of Israel is being forged. And you fellas don't understand that period. You can't imagine what it was like. Friday, Thursday afternoon, the yeshiva ketana that I went to, the only parochial school in the Bronx, Solanta, we were always on the verge of bankruptcy. Who had money then? The concept of a Jewish billionaire being from, it was like thinking today, I'm going to be dancing on the moon tonight. Or when I'm Mekadosh Levana, I'll be standing and on the moon, be looking down and be Mekadosh Levana underneath me. So they used to take us on a sound truck, all the eighth grade kids, and we'd go into the heart of the Bronx. The L would run there, not the subway underground, above ground. They'd come down four different stairways. You came down to the street. And we would stand at each stairway at the bottom with the big flag of the Zionist movement, which becomes the flag of Israel, blue and white. Lavan v'tchelet, and Rabbi Savitz would be on a sound truck, in Yiddish of course, help the yeshiva survive, help these young people survive, help us build a future for the Jewish people, help us get youth that will be committed to Palestine. We have to have a glorious tomorrow, and we have to build on the ashes of Hitler. It was a different era. And you should have seen the people coming down after a hard week of work, crying just to see yeshiva boys and throwing quarters, which was a lot of money, into the flames. Can I tell you a true story from this that you may repeat, but don't forget to say it in my name, Taviu Geula La'olam. It's the greatest story you'll ever hear. Rabbi Savitz was a magician with raising funds. So he used to have two kids stand on the truck with him. One kid was like a cousin to me, Michael Horowitz, Michael J. Horowitz, my mother and his mother, who are both alive, both hitting 100 years of age, were classmates in kindergarten. The other kid was Itzkovitz. Marvin Itzkovitz was a survivor of the Holocaust. Itzkovitz was a big, fat, sloppy, schlubby looking kid. Michael Horowitz is a famous lawyer in Washington today, skinny like a finger. And Rabbi Savitz would go to the people, Nema kuk afte junger man, pointing, say, take a look at this young man, pointing to Michael Horowitz. Et duch gemach de Weltkrieg, he went through World War II, he went through the Lager, the concentration camps. With miracles he survived, and we took him into the yeshiva. Look at his friend. This is an American boy. Look how well fed he is. Look how husky he is. Give us money so we should be able to feed the survivor. And boy, did the money pour out. Gentlemen, Michael Horowitz was as much a survivor as I am a Chinaman speaking coolish Chinese right now. And Itzkowitz was as much as American-born as I'm dancing a flamenco in Spain at this moment in time. You understand? But Rabbi Savitz was fabulous, and I can just see it before my eyes happening. Okay. This is why, when the Siddur appeared, people could not contain themselves. This was not the 30s. This was Reconstruction. This was post-World War II. This was Palestine, by the way, Kaplan was a great Zionist. Palestine is part of Jewish folklore and the Jewish way of life. How do you write such things? How do you propagate such things? Survivors are rebuilding. You already have Chassidim coming into America. The Lubavitcher Rebbe is in America. The Bubavitcher Rebbe is in America. What are you doing? The Satmar Rebbe is about to come to America. What are you doing? How can you talk this way? It didn't play well. This message could not catch on in the 40s the way it conquered in the 30s. And then the faculty members, when already Ginsburg and Lieberman, who was building up a profession, and a reputation, and Professor Alexander Marx came out against Kaplan, it carried weight. In the 30s, the students would have laughed at them. Kaplan was the man. Kaplan was the professor. Kaplan was the teacher. I just spoke with someone today, the very famous position is with my student almost 40 years ago in BMT. He was on the phone with people in Abraham office, so he heard I'm there. Let me talk with Harav Rakefet. And he says to me, Rebbe, the only thing I remember about BMT are your classes. And Baruch Hashem, that has been said to me, and forget it, I don't want to say another word. Let me not praise myself, but let me just tell you, La Havdil, between myself and Mordechai Kaplan, Mordechai Kaplan was the king. Everyone remembered his classes. Everyone remembered his insights. Everyone remembered his popularity. Everyone remembered his sense of humor. He was a teacher par excellence. That was the 30s. By the 40s, it wasn't that he was less of a teacher, but the message had less reception. Finally, and Mordechai Kaplan writes about this, he was very bitter. They tried to force him out. He turned 65. Tried to get rid of him. 1946. They couldn't. He turned 70. They tried to get rid of him. When he turned 75, 1956, the seminary got rid of him. And he was forcibly retired, and he was still in his prime. Follow me? He was blessed with long years. He taught Jewish philosophy, theology, but homiletics. He was a rabbi's rabbi. Mordechai Kaplan, named Kleinekeit Nachum. He went in Aliyah to Israel later, and he lived around the corner from BMT. And we meet, and you know, I'm a young kid at the time. I was your age, a little older perhaps, early 30s. And he shows me, he's wearing tzitzit, and he says to me, you see, I am wearing fringes too, fringes, just like you. I said, yes, Professor Kaplan, I understand that's part of the Jewish civilization. And I gave him a lift, whatever. We, you know, what am I going to fight with him, Mordechai Kaplan? But it was just amazing. And the man was functioning. He was here. He was in Rechavia. At the end, when he started to go downhill physically, they brought him back to America where they had family and he was institutionalized. But that was Mordechai Kaplan. He created a new movement. The movement caught on. It did not thrive. At first, you might think, who knows what would have been with it. Afterwards, it sputtered. I would use that word. They wind up with a rabbinical school in Philadelphia. I think it still exists until today. And they make waves occasionally, as I will show you, but I want to come to the heart of today's shiur. Now, Gil, you wanted to ask something?
Whom did Mordechai Kaplan attribute, like, the authorship of the Torah? Was he into Paschal Bible?
He was way beyond. In other words, what you're asking, he was way beyond. Did these issues, the Jews made it up, was unimportant him when, how? He was way beyond it. In other words, everything, this is the way, the folklore, the way the Jew developed, and then we developed the Talmud, and we developed the Agada, and the Midrash, and it's the people, and you know, you don't have to kill yourself, it's a folklore, way of life. He fasted on Yom Kippur, you understand? He didn't. He wasn't Mechallel Shabbos, at least not B'Parchesia. It's take the theory, you understand? It's what we would call in Israel Mesoratiyim. Mesoratiyim, many of them, whether God exists or not, it's particularly among the Ashkenazim, among the Sfadim, they believe in God. But among the Ashkenazim, all right, it's good to fast on Yom Kippur. It's good to eat matzah and Pesach. This is the Jewish way of life. Belief, I don't know, I'm not certain. You understand what I'm saying? But that was Mordechai Kaplan. He tried to find root. I don't want to go into more detail because he tried to find root for his thinking in the historical school in Germany. You follow? Because when all is said and done, the conservative movement, when you develop the historical school, what is Torah Shebaal Peh? A reflection of the people, not of God. You understand what I'm saying? Torah Shebaal Peh. This is Solomon Schechter, Catholic Israel. This is, to a certain degree, Zacharia Frankel. It's the way the people developed it, the way the people live. See, this is not what we believe. We believe that the basic principles of Torah Shebaal Peh are divine. How you apply it, humans have to apply it. I'm going to give many shurim on this, believe me, in my Sunday class. I'm coming into heavyweight. After B'Samim Rosh is Lahadil Torah Lahadir. You'll really enjoy that. Take my word, Fred. But then we're going to begin a 22-year cycle of God should give strength. But you understand what I'm saying? In other words, the people do play a role. Who determines halacha? Who paskins? We're human beings. So the historical school takes it, and this is the, look, I don't have to play games with you, it's an open Mishnah, Masechet Rosh Hashanah, Perek Bet, the last two Mishnayot, you know what I'm talking about? When you make a mistake, it shows again, the Rosh Chodesh that you call, that is Rosh Chodesh. You follow? So, it's the humans. The Gemara of, in Bab Metzia, Daf Nun Tet, Tanur di Achnayi, right or wrong. God says, Rabbi Elazar is right. The Chachamim say to God, but out of here, it's not your business. We decide. Right or wrong. Now, what does that mean? Torah Shabbat. Look into the Haktamah of the Ksais Achayshin to the Ksais. Look into the Haktamah of the Beit HaLevi to the Beit HaLevi. You'll see what I'm talking about. So you see, there is a certain human involvement in Torah Shabbat Peh. But to go and say, we made up the Torah Shabbat Peh, the Lamed Tet Melachot, yeah, this is where we differ. And he took it that all of Judaism is made up by the person. Commandments without a commander. It's a brilliant article, Baron. I knew Baron. I was a very impressive figure, a big Nebuch, so distant from our concepts of Torah. But there was a certain observance there. In other words, on the Israeli scene, that was the most you could hope for in the Mapai circles, if you understand what I'm saying. Today there's a miracle. Today there's a rebirth. It's a whole different story. But that was 30 years ago. Yes, Michael.
From my knowledge of the seminary,
yeah,
the seminary saw itself as a classical rabbinical school to a great extent, right, from the many of the professors,
right,
that were high-level,
right.
But only two of them really saw themselves as teachers of rabbis who would reach out and deal with the memberships that they would deal with. So in my growing up in Philadelphia in the 50s into the 60s, and I have a pretty good handle on the Philadelphia in the 50s into the 60s, only two really were seen as people who were going to make an impact on their rabbis when they went out into the real world.
Right.
And obviously number one was Kaplan.
Right.
And the second one was Heschel.
Heschel, I'll tell you, I'm not even going to talk about Heschel, I'll tell you why. Heschel plays a very minor role because he was a poet. He was esoteric. He was very, there was a bit of the Kabbalah within him, the Hasidus within him. But an impact he had, but I can't say theologically he shook up the seminary. Neither this way nor that way.
It wasn't minor when he marched.
Right, of course. You're talking about the civil rights.
And against the Vietnam War.
And Martin Luther King and holding hands. Oh, you're absolutely right.
But that had a tremendous impact on the students and
correct.
Generation.
But Heschel was a frum Jew. You got to remember, there's Eidut Nemanah that he never missed a mincha. Unlike Kaplan, who was Reconstructionism with all that that implies. So I agree with you. I mean, I said right away, Kaplan was by far the most, we're going to come to it right now, Kaplan was by far the most dominant figure on the faculty as far as the students were concerned.
And Philadelphia produced four or five giant rabbis who were in the image and the model
of Mordecai Kaplan. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. There's no two ways about it, but the...
And they molded the Philadelphia conservative
movement. But the pinnacle of his success was in the 30s into the 40s. The 40s into the 50s, to quote his own words, he becomes persona non grata at the seminary. Things are shifting, okay? And this is historically true. And you know, Kaplan kept a diary. Are you aware of that? I think there are over 20 volumes, handwritten volumes. I don't think they've ever been published. No one has the money to really edit them and publish them.
In the 30s and the 40s, the rabbis who came out of the seminary, were they really in the mold of Mordecai Kaplan?
No. Some, you know, some were still traditional and yeshiva boys. But the hot shots, you take like Louis Levitsky, Boy of Shalom, he was in the mold of Mordecai Kaplan. The hot shots, the youth, the new generation, he had a tremendous impact. But when you come to the 40s into the 50s, the seminary has shifted gears. The faculty is more traditional. The students are still quite traditional. Yeshiva College is turning out entire classes of the seminary, 60 to 65% Yeshiva College graduates.
And they were totally losing touch with what was going on in their world.
In which world?
In the conservative world, in the conservative shuls.
Well, that's, of course, that's, you know, that's, what can I tell you? The Search for the New Rabbi? Have you read the book of Philadelphia?
I read. That's a much, much
later. Much later. Period. But it shows you what we're talking about, how the rabbis lost touch and how the whole movement moved into a different world altogether. We'll get there. I want to go back with Kaplan. I haven't hit the heart of Kaplan yet. What affects us sitting here today. But I agree with you. Avraham Yeshua Heschel was a figure par excellence, but it was more esoteric. It was not the exoteria of Mordecai Kaplan. And by nature, what Avraham Yeshua Heschel was a philosopher, it's not going to be as popular as a darshan, as a pulpit rabbi, as Mordecai Kaplan hitting home, and with a message that in the 30s and the 40s was very, very popular. Yes,
Nahum. This is that the Torah reveals God. Can't that be seen as implying that sort of like Hashem guided the process along from behind the scenes?
You want to be Malamed Zkut Mordecai Kaplan. I don't think he meant it that way. He simply... Time and again, people will say, did Mordecai Kaplan believe in God or didn't he believe in God? And there's no answer. Follow me? As much as Mordecai Kaplan wrote, no one can answer that question. Because to him, God is incidental. Okay. Gentlemen, now I want to go one step further. What's amazing, and when you look back, if is the largest, most important word in the dictionary. If Mordecai Kaplan, and I am convinced of this, if Mordecai Kaplan had not been in the seminary, the yeshiva and the seminary would have merged in the 1920s. He was the obstacle that no one could overcome. And what's amazing is, really, he didn't fit into the seminary. You talk about Mordecai Kaplan. This type of thinking, this is like Reformed Judaism. Maybe even more extreme than Reformed on a purely theological level. Reformed Jews? At that time, Reformed rabbis still believed in God. Here, a person comes along and God becomes secondary, not pristine, not part of the heart of the whole concept of Torah, Judaism. But you see, life is very different than theory. In theory, correct. But Kaplan was there. Kaplan was at the seminary. That's where he found his nest. That's where he influenced the young birds. That's where he developed his theories. Theologically, what was he doing there? Doesn't matter. That's where he went to school. That's where he grew up. That's where he changed his mind. That's where he altered his positions. So, in the 20s, he is a fixture in the seminary. Now, Hakol Tolui B'Mazel. Chazal say, Afilu Sefer Torah Shebeheichal. You know what that means, right? That when you go to the Sifrei Torah, let's say you have 10 Sifrei Torah, the one you take out is Mazel. If that is Tolui B'Mazel, certainly life depends upon Mazel. And I always say, in life there are three factors: the right man in the right place at the right time. Mordechai Kaplan may have been the wrong man, but he was in the right place. Mordechai Kaplan may have been there at the wrong time, but he was there. And he was a fixture in the seminary. And he was a powerful individual. His shadow was cast on the entire seminary by the mid-late 1920s. Now, what was happening at this time? First of all, I recommend to you, in Rakafer Arum, Chelik Bet, I reproduce postdoctoral research, which I did on Mordechai Kaplan. You all know that in my work on Rabbi Revel, my cousin, I have an entire chapter on the attempt to merge the seminary and the yeshiva. Years later, I did postdoctoral research. Let it be recorded that the editor of the Tel Aviv journal, Michael, in which it was published, Lloyd Gottner, Professor Lloyd Gottner, edited my article and took out some of the material that I was publishing, documents that were too anti-Kaplan. So I want you to know, scholarship has its limits too. He said to me, Professor Kaplan is still alive, it's not nice, we'll see these documents. I said, it's history, these are real documents. Anyway, he published the article without those documents. He said, some other time you'll publish them. Obviously, that other time will never come, because once an article is published, the heart of it is correct. But I just want you to be aware that it was edited by a seminary graduate, Lloyd Gottner, who was teaching at Tel Aviv U at that time, and was the editor of Michael or Michael, which was a journal, a yearbook, a hardcover book dealing with the diaspora communities outside of Israel. So I republished in Rakafer Arum Chelik Bet, and it's worth going into the article in detail, but let me give you the heart of it. What was happening in the mid-20s? Rabbi Revel comes to this little yeshiva on the east side of New York, 1915, and he opens up a high school. All of you know there's a whole history about the high school. The students started clamoring and striking already in 1907, 1908. You can read Gil Klapman's doctorate. It's been published, The History of Yeshiva University. And students were clamoring, we want a high school. The board of directors of Yeshiva Reb Tzvi Chanan said very simply, what do we need a high school for? We never went to high school, and we still make good money in America. We don't believe in a high school, a yeshiva, and dafna zitzen and learn, and we just have to sit and learn. The Balabatim were opposed to it. The boy struck, and water takes time, but even a stone will be watered down, will be chipped away by rain. By 1915, the Balabatim and the rabbis running Yeshiva Sipchon and all agreed, without a high school, the yeshiva has no future. Who could head up the high school miraculously? Rabbi Revel is in Oklahoma with his family's oil business, a big Talmud Chacham, a PhD from Drapsi. They bring him to New York, and he organizes Talmudical Academy. Years go by, Talmudical Academy is a thriving institution. Thank God it still thrives until this very day. I am a TA graduate, and I know many of my students have their sons at TA today, and they're very pleased. It's a school that resuscitated itself. Among the Rebbeim are my own students from this kollel. So, time marches on, and kids are not just going to high school now. They're going to Columbia University if they have money. If they don't have money, they're going to the City College of New York, CCNY, which arguably was the top intellectual experience in New York City at that time. It's not like the city colleges today, where you have a real problem because of the quality of the students there. Rabbi Rebel feels very bad that Yeshiva TA, the best graduates, leave Yeshiva, go on to Columbia or CCNY. By the early 20s, by the mid-20s, he declares, just as the yeshiva logically had to develop a high school, we now have to develop a college. And the plans are announced to build Yeshiva College. They go looking for a campus. They go way uptown where there was just farms at the time, Washington Heights, cows, pasture land. They buy a tremendous tract of land, of which they only own about a quarter today. Three quarters were sold off during the Depression. A lot of the land that they buy back, house by house today, was originally Yeshiva University land. It's a sad story, but that was the Depression. That was the reality. Now they have to announce a building campaign. They announce, I believe it was a $5 million, all the facts are in Bernard Rebel, a $5 million building campaign to build the most modern campus for Yeshiva and Yeshiva College uptown in Washington Heights. So they go to work fundraising. Gentlemen, they never came anywhere near $5 million. They did achieve a miracle. They did raise in pledges, some was paid already, $3 million, which was a tremendous sum at that time. I don't know what it would be translated into 2010 money, but certainly it's a fabulous sum. The yeshiva had its operating budget. Finances were a real difficulty. The seminary is functioning, expanding, succeeding. You have second generation Americans. Remember I explained this, the East European kids who grew up in America, like my father, like my family. And they were very happy to have seminary rabbis who spoke English and had proper deportment. I told you, walked into a room, took off their hats, sat with a yarmulke. Remember my word, that today if you wear a yarmulke instead of a hat, you won't get a rabbinate. In those days, you lost the rabbinate if you were wearing a hat and didn't know enough to take it off in the presence of ladies. All right. Gentlemen, the seminary also was a tremendous burden. Tremendous budget. Now, you have to remember, there were many balabatim like Adler, who we spoke about. Not Adler, so whom am I thinking of? Strauss, right? Who was from, raised from, and remember I spoke about him originally, one second, I have the name here. Schiff, thank you. Adler, I'm getting confused, and Strauss was also a balabas, but we're talking about Jacob Schiff, thank you. And many balabatim like Jacob Schiff, who were raised from, became reform, but wanted to quote Jacob Schiff, an enlightened orthodoxy in America. There was Louis Marshall, the great jurist, great lawyer. Was he a member of the Supreme Court? Did Louis Marshall ever make it? No, he was only a lawyer.
Cardozo was like that.
But he didn't play a role here. Louis Marshall played a major role. He was the Mr. American Balabas. Zionism, Judaism, it was reform. But he knew there had to be some sort of orthodoxy in America. And they were on the Balabatim. They looked around. What is the big difference between the seminary and the yeshiva? To paraphrase the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Chelek. Elu Ovdei Hashem, the Elu Ovdei Hashem. Right along. Elu Shomrei Shabbat, the Elu Shomrei Shabbat. Elu Shomrei Kashrut, the Elu Shomrei Kashrut. Aye, the seminary has shuls already where there's no mechitza, where there's mixed seating. No, it's a minor issue. What's the big deal? The seminary did not have synagogues at that time that had organs. No, mixed seating. It's a minor problem. Many of the seminary synagogues had separate seating, just no mechitza. The women were happy to sit there. I saw these synagogues. I worked for them. My second job in the Talmud Torah, we'll talk about it, was a concourse center on the Grand Concourse, the Bronx. No, the men sat here, the women sat here. There was no, the downstairs shul, the Beis Medrash had a mechitza. That's why I davened, then I had to run a youth service. But upstairs, there was separate seating. The women were happy. The women here, the men here, no big difference. No mechitza. Money speaks. A balabas is money oriented. Nothing has changed. That's the role of a balabas. Why don't we merge the two? It would solve the problems of the yeshiva and the problems of the seminary. Merge the two. The college is a fabulous idea. You got to raise $5 million. Imagine having Jacob Schiff, Louis Marshall, having that whole crowd behind you as well. Ultimately, the yeshiva has to turn to that crowd. Who do they honor among the original recipients of honorary doctorates? Governor Lehman, Senator Lehman, no, Herbert S. Lehman, Temple Emanuel, Albert Einstein. He didn't even go to Temple Emanuel. Didn't go to any shul, as far as I know. You follow me, Danny? Yeshiva later had to get involved with these people, willy-nilly. It's an interesting question. We were allowed to honor them. This is a very, not a simple matter. I raised the issue on a much lower level. In Stern College, they gave it an award to a teacher. I don't want to mention details. I know the teacher. She's not married. Refused to get married. I know a Talmud of mine proposed marriage to her. She left it and she's not getting married. Her father died of aggravation from family. They don't want to get married. Not as far as I know, she's not a lesbian. But Simitia doesn't want to get married. Doesn't want children. She's a professor. There's that. Doesn't want the burden of a husband. Might have to cook. I don't know. No, I'm serious. There's nothing to laugh. It's tragic. So I said, how do you honor a woman like this? This is a role model for 2,000 Stern College girls to see? These are very delicate questions. You understand me, Shmuel? You honor Herbert S. Lehman? You're taking the president of Temple Emanuel, who happens to be the governor of the state of New York, the senator of the state of New York. Fine, good, wonderful. But you're saying to the students, just because he has money or influence, kizerei v'kadesh. It's a delicate issue. So don't be negative. You're going to get Louis Marshall behind you. You're going to get, this is fabulous. Gentlemen, I want you to know there were very, very serious negotiations. And let me read a document to you that says it all. Fascinating document. I'm quoting from Rakafet Aron, page 186, although the article originally appeared in the journal Michael, but Rakafet Aron is readily available today, and as you can find Michael any place out of the Tel Aviv Library and the National Library here, I'll dance a kazatska on the moon Belineta. Gentlemen, mention Concourse Center of Israel to you. Let me take you back in time. I must be the only person alive who met all these people eye to eye. Concourse Center of Israel, the Grand Concourse. Michael, I know you're from Philadelphia. Do you have any idea what the Grand Concourse was in the Bronx? Grand, underline the word grand. All the novels talk about the grand. If you lived on the Grand Concourse, you made it. So there was this beautiful synagogue. It burned down a year ago, you should know. It's a church today. It burned down. I heard in the news. I was shocked. Concourse Center. The rabbi there was Max Straub. I can give you his years. 1887-1959. Was a 1911 graduate of the seminary. Gentlemen, I knew him. I knew him. Tall, distinguished. A Van Dyke, looked like a German rabbi. A Shomer Shabbos, 100%. Graduate of the seminary. The Concourse Center, like I told you, separate seating, no mechitza. Downstairs, to satisfy the Zaydas and the Bubbas, and guys like me, there was a base medrash with a machitza, proper machitza, you know, with an early minyan Shabbos. So when I worked there, the year I got smicha, I was able to daven there, and then I ran a youth service, and all right, Baruch Hashem. Drab was involved in the negotiations. He wrote a confidential letter to Dr. Adler, Cyrus Adler at the seminary. Cyrus Adler got the letter, and he said, and he asked Rabbi Drob's permission, allow me to share this letter with Louis Marshall, because he's the boss and, you know, the head late person, and the letter is very important. And I'll summarize March 15th, 1926, and he tells Dr. Adler, I was just in touch with the leaders of the yeshiva group, and they spoke to me degree and said to me things that they would never say to you or Mr. Marshall. Now, what does that mean? Very simple. Dr. Drob, Rabbi Drob, was persona non grata to many Orthodox Jews. These East Europeans could not let their head down with Cyrus Adler or Louis Marshall. But Drob, who was second generation East European, not a cold German reform balabas, mit dem haben sie gekannt reden Mamelaschen. How do you translate that? With him they could speak, yeah, you know, the truth. Lashon shel ha'ima. And he says, let me explain to you, and this is so fascinating, what are the real problems in the merger? Now I have to tell you, he lists four problems. Only the fourth is insurmountable. The other three, I'll tell you right away how they could have been solved. The yeshiva group, number one, curriculum. The yeshiva group would insist upon a curriculum which would grant a real hatarat hora'ah, traditional ordination. And that means they would have to know codes, the ability to decide ritual questions. So that the seminary's curriculum now, which is so multifaceted, could not be in place in a merger with the yeshiva. Such a curriculum would mean in the future men of the type, and he lists out very prominent conservative rabbis, Jacob Cohn, Israel Goldstein, recognized the name, the Israel Goldstein Youth Village, Norman Salad, Elias Solomon, will be kept out of the ministry. They don't have a paskin, but they're good preachers, teachers. I would prefer any day Jacob Cohn to T.S. Who is T.S.? So I have a footnote. T.S. was a European-trained Talmudic scholar who graduated from the seminary. He was a Talmud Chacham. Who was T.S.? I did my research. I could not come up with a name for sure. The only graduate of the seminary from this era who had the initials T.S. was Theodore Shab, S-H-A-B. Graduated the seminary in 1921. I Googled him, could not find anything about him outside of my footnote. If anyone listening knows who Theodore, am I right? Theodore Shab, was he a European-trained Talmud Chacham? What did he do after he graduated the seminary? If anyone knows, contact us. All right, this is criticism number one.
I'm saying that.
Two, the yeshiva group not only objects to our present curriculum, but to the method of instruction. It is the historical method. And the yeshiva group will even criticize Professor Hoshanda. Jacob Hoshanda was a professor of Bible, taught at Dropsy, taught at JTS, very conservative in his views, a tremendous critic of Wellhausen, but nevertheless, he took a historical scientific approach. The yeshiva could not accept this. Number three, the yeshiva group is unalterably opposed to sending rabbis to any but strictly Orthodox congregations. This would mean the breaking of relations with those synagogues which are today the backbone of the United Synagogue. So these are the first three objections. gentlemen, it's very fascinating. It could very well be, as yeshiva developed, all these problems were solved. Perhaps not the way we would like, but solved nevertheless. Let's work backwards. Number three, by the 1940s, most yeshiva graduates were going to synagogues that did not have mechitza. Most Chaim Berlin graduates, Torah Vadas graduates, were going to synagogues that did not have mechitza. This was the reality. I don't have to go into detail now. You're all aware of it. A lot has been written about it. It's not that we were happy about it, but simply rabbis had to make a living. So they would go and get a heter if you can convert and teach and impress upon them. Many of them became conservative rabbis. Some of them remained Orthodox rabbis in conservative temples. Some of them actually succeeded as years moved on and as American Jewry changed. So number three ameliorated itself. As far as the curriculum and the method of teaching, what does yeshiva have today? Gentlemen, you have two different schools. Rietz and Bernard Revel Graduate School. Rietz is traditional. The old-fashioned method. You open a Gemara. Min learn Zapadaf Gemara. You learn Rashi. You learn Taisvat. You learn Rambam. You learn Ravit. You learn a Reb Chaim. No one is going into textual critical studies. No one is going into sociological, economic, historic factors. Is, as far as I know, the way they study in Rietz and the way they study in Gris Kollel, and I see Rabbi Lichtenstein is going to give a public shiur this week, right? A shiur klali. So, as far as I know, it is totally traditional. Am I correct, David? What do you say? No difference the way they give a shiur here to the way they give a shiur in Lakewood, or give a shiur in Panovich, or give a shiur, and if I or give a shiur any yeshiva you will mention, Merkaz Harav, Chevron, and if I'm to believe the yeshiva publicity, our shiurim are better than any shiurim in the world. I sound like a chauvinist, a jingoist. Let it be. Let it be. But then you go to Bernard Revel Graduate School, at least in my time. Historical, critical, scientific. We even had scientific Talmud. Who was the, no, give me the name of the professor. But who was his Rebbe? You're taking Avraham Weiss, Professor Avraham Weiss. That was Chanuch Albeck's brother-in-law. Do you know Professor Weiss's Sfarim? He recreated all the Gemaras. He went according chronologically. How you have to recreate the Gemara. What order follows what order? What are you talking about? Bernard Revel Graduate School was as critical and as scientific as Hebrew University at the time, as Bar Ilan University at the time. Bernard Revel? Wow. So you see, ultimately you could have solved the problem very sweetly and gently. On an undergraduate level, all the studies are traditional. The curriculum is traditional. The approach is traditional. On a postgraduate level, students who want to can pursue a doctorate in a scientific school that would be unique to JTS Yeshiva University, no different than Bernard Revel was. And to a certain degree is. I know that there's no critical Talmud taught anymore at Bernard Revel. That's what I'm told. That the you can fill me in. Is there a critical? Who teaches? Professor Elman. I wouldn't exactly say it's Avraham Weiss. There's a world of difference. Professor Elman is a tremendous yatin, but a very traditional person. A very different. Professor Weiss was the firmest Jew I knew. And his kids are all fabulous and all live in Israel. But his approach to Talmud, he once told his doctor, who was my doctor, who was a Yerpeisha too, learned in yeshiva in his youth, he said, no one can understand my books because you have to cut the Gemara up and repaste it and it's too difficult for the average individual. Gentlemen, finally we've reached the apex and the conclusion of this year. You guessed it. Point number four, there's no way to solve the problem of Professor Kaplan. The yeshiva group considers the seminary the citadel of atheism because Professor Kaplan teaches there. Under no condition will they countenance the union with the seminary as long as he's retained on the faculty. I had spoken to the most liberal-minded of the group, and they tell me this is the crux of the entire problem. Can we afford to have Kaplan again brought up for discussion? And are we really ready to eliminate him? A rhetorical question. And gentlemen, right there, you have the heart of the problem. Kaplan was the most famous teacher. The students loved him. The Balabatan was smart, and I've seen this replay out over the decades in many situations in our world. If only they could get rid of that Kaplan. The money they could save, the merger, the dollars and cents that wouldn't be wasted, the overlapping in their minds of two institutions. Who needs two Orthodox rabbinic seminaries or enlightened Orthodox rabbinic seminaries? Who needs two different institutions, two different campuses? How many students are we talking about? If we can only get rid of Mordechai Kaplan. But gentlemen, in order to get rid of Mordechai Kaplan, they will follow Batim, who would have left the seminary, left the support, the Lamport families, other families. He was their rabbi. He was their God. What did Mr. Jesselson say about Yitz Greenberg when this issue first broke in the 1980s? And Yitz Greenberg said, we no longer have to believe in God after the Holocaust. Remember the famous lecture he gave at the University of Denver? Later it's published. Our covenant with God is no longer obligatory. It's voluntary. And after the Holocaust, we can choose to be Orthodox, conservative, reform, or nothing, whatever. So they wanted to throw Yitz Greenberg out of the Rabbinical Council of America. His balabus from Riverdale, he was then rabbi of the Jewish Center of Riverdale, where Rabbi Rosenblatt is today, Mr. Jesselson, Ludi Jesselson, Mr. Yeshiva University, chairman of the board afterwards, board of trustees, called the RCA, said, if one hair from my rabbi's head is touched, I stop my contribution to Torah Fund. And he was the single biggest contributor, $100,000 a year to RCA's Torah Fund. You follow me, Danny? He's a balabatim. This is his rabbi. Balabatim, you touch one hair on Mordechai Kaplan's head, I'm finished. I'm walking out. They couldn't solve it. And I saw this not only from this letter, time and time and time again. And in this letter, they treat Mordechai Kaplan with gloves. Citadel of Atheism, you should see some other letters, and even from seminary people who write, we have to get rid of this man. He's a curse. The way he thinks, the way he teaches. Gentlemen, this was a very important moment in the seminary's history. It doesn't end here. What I'm going to show you next week is beyond comprehension. But I have the source. It is true. It happened. So to reiterate, well, we've done a lot. We've gotten there. Ginsberg, Schechter before him, Cyrus Adler. But Mordechai Kaplan, what a role. What influence. What charisma. And just think what could have been. But they couldn't solve the problem. To get rid of him, we offend Balabatim, and we offend students. I have to tell you, people can't think they were unhappy with a certain faculty member at YU. If I would talk to him, he should retire earlier. They would Balabatim. They would have loved to get rid of him. Would have brought in endless millions of dollars more to YU. And I told him, the most popular faculty member. Everyone's going to know he was forced out. You're going to have a student rebellion on your hands. You think twice whether 10, 20, 30 million is worth a student rebellion and all the inherent publicity which will ultimately reach the New York Times. This is the same thing with Mordechai Kaplan. Student students would have gone to the barricades for him. It's not a simple matter. And Max Drobe understood it because he lived in the seminary world but was persona grata in the East European Torah world of that period. And I remember him fondly. He was succeeded by Rabbi Morris Berman. Do you recognize the name? And it was Morris Berman's older brother who was one of the Karbanot in Hebron in 1929. His brother went to study with the Levash Mordechai Hebron Yeshiva. He was a musmach of the yeshiva. And he and a high school graduate, an MTA graduate, Hurwitz, was a Talmudical Academy graduate. He too went to study in Hebron, and they were the first two Karbonot Alat Mata Kodesh of graduates of what today is Yeshiva University. Excuse me? In whose name?
IBC, I think.
Yeah, in whose name? In Hurwitz? Berman and Hurwitz. Very nice, very nice. It's important to remember. Gentlemen, Sunday is a great day in our history of teaching. We finish up the Holocaust, 6 years of work, and I have an interesting finality, and I show you how the Rav was knocked out by the Rav, and it's very fascinating and leaves you thinking, and it all comes back to Fuk Hazim Mayamad Davar. Then we begin the Besamim Rosh. And if I could, I would want to go back in time and I put Yeshiva University on the map, 1770, and I can assure you that the Besamim Rosh would have been the Rosh Yeshiva and we would have carried him on our hands. And take a look what happened to Nebuch. He was born before his time. I have something that every rabbi should have a copy of. Not long ago, Rabbi Dor, Rosh Yeshiva of Chorev, shared this story with me. One morning during the first week of marriage, I davened at Rav Amital's minyan in Givat Mordechai. Rav Amital approached me after davening and said, "Do you know why you got married?" I looked at this curious question and shrugged. He continued, quote, "You are a Kolenik now. Well, one day you will be a Talmud Chacham, maybe a Rosh Yeshiva. People will call you Harav Hagon. And after a while, you'll start to believe them. That's why you got married. So when you get home at night, you have a wife to remind you who you really are." If anyone wants a copy, I made copies. Gentlemen, this is the interview from Hamavaseh with Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler. And here you see everything I told you about the seminary, how correct I was. He says at the table he studied in the Yeshiva Space Medrash, there were five other people. My Chavrusa, Rav Chaim Bodek, and I were the only ones to remain here. The other four went to Schechter Seminary. It's a fabulous interview. Gentlemen, an in-depth study of the rabbi who performed the wedding for Clinton's daughter to a Jewish-born male on Shabbos. For us, it's a tragedy because he studied in an Orthodox institution, so-called, and look what happened to him. Studied in Shalavim, studied in Hartman's. It's a terrible, terrible story. Gentlemen, yesterday in the New York Times magazine section, there was an article on a restaurant of Chabad in Crown Heights. I highly recommend this article to you. Take what you wish, and until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. David, you are now responsible for reporting back to me which recording was the best. Remember their way.